welcome to the first episode of Marta Vogt Podcast, a podcast in which young women in science share stories behind their academic CVs. I am Natale, and this podcast is produced by Forschungsverbund Berlin, a non-university, non-profit research organization in Berlin, Germany. Along with the Marta Vogt Award, an annual award for an outstanding young female researcher, this podcast aims to support and in particular increase the visibility of women scientists at early career stages. If you would like to learn more about the organization and the idea behind the podcast, I invite you to check the pilot episode of this series. In this first episode, I am visiting the Leibniz Research Institute for Molecular Pharmacology, located in the Biotech Campus Berlin Buch in the northern part of Berlin. This location also has a special meaning for this podcast. At the beginning of the century, here was located the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Brain Science. And between 1929 and 1935, in this institute was doing her research on neurotransmitters Marta Luisa Vogt, the name giver of this podcast. Today, the house of the Leibniz Research Institute for Molecular Pharmacology carries the name Marta Vogt House in her honor. And here I'm meeting with Dr. Gillian Dornan. Gillian is a postdoc researcher at the Department of Molecular Physiology and Cell Biology. Slightly more than a year ago, Gillian has received the prestigious Bantin Fellowship of the Canadian government and came to Berlin to do a research on the lipid kinase and cell signaling. Her goal is to understand factors that cause immunodeficiencies and cancers. Before that, Gillian completed her PhD in biochemistry at the University of Victoria in Canada and master and bachelor degrees in the field of molecular genetics at the University of Leicester in the UK. Enjoy listening. So hi, Gillian, glad to see you and thank you very much for your time. As I know, it has been already a couple of months since you're back to the lab after the quarantine. How has this pandemic affected your research?
Well, I am a wet lab researcher, so of course we had to shut everything down, all the facilities except for the kind of bare bones, like the mouse house was maintained at very low levels. Of course, this one is not important for me, but for other researchers. But in general, I'd luckily finished a couple projects that I could analyze, and I had a review that I could start writing. But in general, I was not doing a whole lot in terms of productivity. So everyone's research here got shut down, and it's been quite nice to be back for sure.
And what have you missed most from the lab work, from the institute work while you were at home?
There are two things. One thing that's obviously on probably everyone's mind is the social aspect. Science is a really collaborative effort. We work a lot in teams, especially in this lab, which is quite large. And just the day-to-day banter and going for lunch, that's really enjoyable, discussing your research problems. But then secondly, for me, which what is really important is having a schedule, having routine. And it was a little bit hard to make a proper routine when we were in the lockdown because there's no things commanding your attention at any time. You're kind of free to plan your day and it doesn't always go so well. So I've missed kind of those two things.
And is there something that you can call was an upside of this experience, something that you will take to your work after?
Ooh, for the work, that's... I guess it gives you a lot of time for introspection, which can help you reflect on your career. And that was definitely a positive, a time away to have to think. Because when you're in the lab, you're always going for it. You're trying to get as much done as possible, or you're chatting with people. But the introspection on your career is really an important thing for everyone. And I don't think anyone usually feels that they have the time to effectively do that. Also, it's nice to be able to work out whenever you want or to eat whenever you want. Whereas here, of course, we are reliant on the Mensa. So yeah, those were a couple nice points, yeah.
And about introspection of your career, what were your thoughts? Did you come up with something?
Not really, but that's okay, right? It's okay to think about these things and not have a final answer. So I also was in a similar position during the last recession where I was unemployed for quite some time and I was living at home. And so I had a lot of time while I was doing little mini jobs or while I was applying for different jobs and thinking about my career then. So I've really had that emphasis brought forward. So I just continue to do the same thing and to think about whether I want to stay on the academic career path or whether I want to go into industry and think about my network and how I can improve things.
This last recession that you mentioned, was it after your PhD, during your PhD, or was it even before that time?
It was before that time. So it was, I guess it happened right when I was finishing my undergrad. So I decided, I guess it's a good idea to do a master's at least first, because maybe the economy will be a lot better than it wasn't, at least in Canada for science, because Canada's industry is quite small comparatively. And so there just weren't any jobs for the amount of people coming out of the universities. But it was very difficult. But I ended up getting a job. So I ended up moving back to the UK, which is where I did my master's and my undergrad. And I got a job almost right away at one of the best institutes in the world. So that was really actually awesome.
You did your master's at the Leicester University in the UK, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And you did your master in genetic studies of bumblebees, actually.
Yeah.
And how was your path from the genetics of bumblebees to what are you doing now? So it was not a straightforward process from master's to PhD, as I understand. Can you tell about this?
That's correct. So I actually really enjoyed my master's and the lab I was working in, but I wasn't sure if that's the type of work I wanted to do. And so I wanted to dabble a bit more because I'd done, you know, I went straight through the academic career, pathway, bachelor, master's, and I didn't have time to think about my career, of course. And that comes back to that introspection. And so I thought, I'll just, you know, I'll get a job, anything that really appeals to me in and it builds on the skills that I've already made, then I'll just take it and I'll see if I like this aspect as well. And then I can think about whether I want to do a PhD or what I want to do next. And so I actually ended up getting a job in the structural studies unit at the Laboratory of Molecular Biology. And I worked in two different labs, one in the molecular machinery of the dynein motor. So that walks up and down, walks one way in microtubules and carries, transports things in the cell. And then another lab was on, it actually kind of did a little bit of everything molecular machine wise. So I was working on the Fanconi anemia complex and also the cleavage and polydenylation factor complex. So these large molecular machines and how they function and what their structure is. And so that kind of was a very broad amount of research that I could think about and whether I wanted to stay in those fields or whether I wanted to change it up as well.
So you did a lot of experimental work with the machines and analysis before you actually said, now I want to continue my academic path and go for PhD.
Sort of. So I started out really technical in that job. So I was working with insect cells and helping to establish kind of a larger scale facility at the institute, especially in their newer building. But I was also working on projects with some postdocs. And I wasn't doing so much the large and important experiments, but really the kind of the base work, like the cloning and the initial expression trials to give to the postdoc so that they could have something to work with and to do the experiments. But they were always, what was really nice about this institute was everyone was really so excited to share their research. And so I was never kept out of the loop. All the postdocs, both the ones I worked with and the ones outside, would always talk to me about their research and the questions they were asking and the experiments they were doing. So I was kind of exposed to a lot of things, even though I wasn't doing them all.
And do you remember the moment when you decided that you want to proceed to PhD?
It was kind of like roughly, I'd always been thinking about it, but definitely it was kind of at the end of my first year where I thought, okay, I've been doing this for a while. I really enjoy it and I'm really excited to try something bigger. And I think now is the time because, of course, I'm more mature compared to a lot of people who just, they do their undergrad and in Germany they do their master's, but in other countries in the world, they just go straight to PhD. And so they come out quite young, especially in the UK. And so when I started my PhD, I was actually 25 or 26. I think 26. So I was already mature, and I thought I should do it now. I don't want to wait too long, because then maybe there's no point for me to do it. That's not true for everyone. That was just my own thought process for myself.
And you think this exposure to what the postdocs were doing also helped for you to understand that it's probably you would like to go this path as well?
Yes, for sure. 100%. Yeah.
Can you tell a bit more what are you doing now? As I understood, you're investigating the fundamental mechanism of how cells interact or communicate with each other.
So not how the cells communicate with each other necessarily, but how, I mean, yes, to some extent, but it's more, in my PhD, I was looking at this one enzyme, PI3K, and that's a lipid kinase that is important for the transduction of these extracellular signals within to the cell. So yes, I guess cell-cell communication. But now the enzyme work on, it's a similar enzyme. It's another of the PI3Ks, so it's a different class of them. And they're important in also, to some extent, signaling, but a lot of membrane trafficking aspects as well. And that's a bit different.
This is a very fundamental research. And many young researchers, they start to lose their motivation because of this lack of impact that they start to feel about their research. And can you share what inspires you in the fundamental research and why did you decide to go for it?
That's an excellent question. Yes, I can actually, as soon as you said that young researchers are losing their motivation because of the lack of impact, I can still remember in my PhD, I think my PhD work is actually a lot more translational to some extent than others, because we could see this mutation can be fixed, or the effect of this mutation can be fixed by these inhibitors. So we could see a direct impact for actual patients. But I still remember thinking, oh, this isn't the biggest question we could be asking, and feeling really demotivated. And I think that can also happen a lot when you're stuck troubleshooting in experiments, or you're just doing the really basics. I've seen it happen with, we worked with a lot of undergrad researchers as either co-op students, or they were doing course credits in our lab. And you could see, like, if they were just doing cloning, which it can be very tedious, they would start losing their motivation for sure. And I think you have to keep reminding yourself about what questions you're asking. And I think a lot of PhD students don't have this time at the beginning of their PhD to really think about the big picture questions. And you have to keep those in your mind. So it's thinking about, I guess, the big picture as the forest, right? Mm-hmm. So you can see the whole forest, as opposed to getting lost in the details, like the bark of the tree or the leaves. And when you can keep having that big picture view, you can remind yourself of why you're doing it in the first place, which is really important. But I think what was really good for coming into this postdoc was that I actually applied for fellowships before I came. And so I came into the postdoc already having a big picture view of what I was doing. Not everyone has that. And so it was really nice to be able to have that time to focus on that important aspect. So when I'm doing cloning here or doing something that's really tedious, which is true for all jobs, but wet lab especially, there's a lot of things that you just have to do to go forward. I think about these aspects, and that can keep me motivated for sure.
And going back to your PhD time again, was there anything else that was a hard challenge for you during this time?
Yeah, so I've had a lot of mental health problems, and this is actually a massive problem in academia and probably other fields as well. And it wasn't any one reason that I had these problems, and it's 100% okay to have them, but this was particularly challenging because sometimes you have, you know, depression because of a reason. So, you know, you've lost someone, or, you know, something major has happened in your life, and maybe during the PhD it doesn't feel like this. You feel like you are depressed for no reason, and that can be really a challenge to get over that. And also, I guess, seeing other people suffer as well during the PhD, this happens, and there are people who are also not having a good time, and you can't really necessarily do anything concrete to help them. And that was I think one of the most challenging things. But yeah, I think that was pretty much the biggest thing for my PhD.
Did you find a way to deal with this? What was your methods, let's say?
So for anything mental health, what you should do before you start off in your new place is you should look up the resources. And if they aren't there, you should advocate for them. So we had access to counselors and doctors and psychiatrists if you needed that. It wasn't the best access, but it was there. And also establish a support network as soon as possible. Your support network is super important, and you should probably have quite an extended support network. You have your close friends who you can talk to more intimately, but also a couple other people. You don't want to focus on one person and bring them down necessarily, but having that network is super important to help you on those bad days and to help you get through. I think that there needs to be a lot more money put into resources for mental health, especially for every stage. So PhD researchers, postdocs, even like junior and senior group leaders, everyone has mental health problems, but there's just not enough resources for mental health. And I think this needs to be changed. So that's what I kind of did, or how I got over it eventually was to go into those resources and access those.
So you reached out for help from the resources that were available at the institution.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is great when they are available.
Yes, of course. Yes. Yeah.
Although I think it's also very important to really understand early what you have is a depression, or you have some troubles and you need to reach out for help. And I think this is not very common for PhD students. And it's also part of the culture that you have to hold on, and this is hard and you just have to do it. And you're just complaining, probably, right? This is also part of the culture that is very difficult to change, I guess, in the academia.
Yes, it's extremely inherent to academia. But I think things are changing. I see a lot of people kind of throughout the world who are starting to speak up and starting to say, no, we are rejecting this culture of we need to pick ourselves up by our bootstraps or have the stiff upper lip. We need to acknowledge these problems and let people know that they can have them and these are the signs of them, so that they can recognize it in themselves and where they can go to get help. But it's definitely changing, but of course it's not fast enough. I definitely recommend going on Twitter, because there's a whole network out there for PhD students and actually academics and mental health. One, for example, is PhD Balance, I think. And that's finding balance with your mental health as a PhD student. But you're right, it's a huge problem. And I don't know the best way to get people to be more aware of it. Mm-hmm. But definitely, it's not just awareness, but the resources. Because once mm-hmm. you go, okay, I'm depressed, what now?
Who do I go for? Shall I go to my supervisor, for example?
Exactly. And a lot of PhD students absolutely do not feel comfortable going to their supervisor. And there's a reason for that, because some supervisors are not supportive in that. And it's not necessarily that they are meaning to be malicious, but maybe a lot of supervisors haven't had the problems themselves, or they got over it in their own way and they don't recognize that that might not be suitable for everyone. And it can also, because of this power structure in academia, you might be putting yourself at risk and your position at risk mm-hmm. by telling your supervisor or going to them, when maybe you can start by going somewhere else first.
But also you mentioned that supervisors are not necessarily trained, and it's also a question, they are not supposed to be mental health
practitioners,
yeah. Right. But I know that at the FMPE you're involved in the postdoc PhD network. And can you tell a bit more about this? Why is it important for you, and what are the goals of this network?
So overall, we are scheduling kind of not just social, but more networking type events. So we have our pizza lunches where we invite group leaders or people from industry to talk about their careers. We also have our postdoc day, which has of course been postponed, which we hope to hold in either October or November. I don't think we've settled on a date yet, where we can also network with all the other postdocs around Berlin and share our science. So I guess that's kind of like the overall goal, is that we're still having this scientific aspect, mm-hmm. but we want to focus on getting postdocs different resources. So language courses, helping postdocs navigate difficult situations, so they can always contact our postdoc email and say, hey, I'm having this problem, can you help me? Or, hey, I want to do this type of course? Is it possible to facilitate it here at the FMP? It's kind of like a broad network, but our kind of core things that we do is really organize these events so that we all can network a bit more.
But it's also, in a sense, this kind of support system that you were talking before, so that people can reach out and see the others with the similar problems. So creating a safe environment for people to be able to share these issues if they have some.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. Or at least help them figure out how to, mm-hmm. to go forward, kind of have a neutral, not completely neutral, still on your side because we're postdocs and we mm-hmm. want to represent you, but have someone who's like out of the situation mm-hmm. and to say, yes, this makes sense, or no, this doesn't, or where do you go next, really? And I did a lot of this work in my PhD as well. Mm-hmm. So I was part of the Graduate Student Society. And so I helped, well, specifically, I was the director of student affairs. People would potentially come to me with their problems and I'd help them navigate the system, because every institute, every university has a flow path of mm-hmm. what you can do to help facilitate the easing of the conflict.
And you mentioned also that as a part of this postdoc PhD network here, you also organize sort of courses for postdocs and PhDs to develop certain skills. And what are the important skills that you consider for a senior scientist to have, so that the PhD or postdoc have to think about developing during their postdoc phase, for example?
Yeah. So, of course, the basic stuff that you're doing in lab, that can be so different depending on what field you're in. But there are really these core kind of things that you need to be able to do as a researcher. And that is, one of the big ones, of course, is communication. Clear, concise, effective communication. Most people don't know how to do that. I also don't think I know how to do that. And being able to communicate your science, as well as working in a team. So it's all these soft skills that people kind of neglect traditionally in science. Everyone's focusing on having, oh yeah, I can do cell culture, I can do a PCR, I can do this analysis, but really it's those soft skills. Also writing, which is also a communication form, presentation skills, mm-hmm. critical thinking is a big one, and then general logical skills to be able to troubleshoot problems that you have, so problem solving. These things I'd think about in a greater aspect and how it applies to your work, because of course it'll depend on what field you're in, but we all need to be able to critically assess the science that we're reading to be able to guide our own science forward. And what is the other one? There's another one that I was thinking of. Right, statistics. Everyone pretty much has to do statistics, and everyone's always messing it up. And I think that's a really big one that should have more of a focus, especially in the biological sciences, because I think a lot of people aren't thinking about it correctly. So these types of courses are actually important, mm-hmm. maybe experimental design as well, mm-hmm. but that I think is made up of those other core components I already just said.
It's funny you say about statistics, because from my position, I would take it for granted that the researchers, especially in biological science, have to be very familiar and very good with statistics, but it appears this is not the case. And this is also probably okay to acknowledge this and go mm-hmm. for the courses and so on.
100%. I did statistics for biological sciences in undergrad, but it was just regular statistics where they say, okay, you have some birds that you're watching the tree, and this many birds have this, and this many birds have this other phenotype. What is the statistics that you use? This type of thing, where it's not necessarily, I don't feel it is as applicable to my work, because mm-hmm. I'm not an ecologist, etc. But you really have to maybe either find a basic course for, you know, molecular sciences, or you have to also look at a bunch of different papers in the field and say, okay, what is everyone doing and does this make sense? Mm-hmm. So that goes back to that critical assessment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But we do take it for granted, because oftentimes you're like, oh yeah, I just do a t-test, whatever, it's mm-hmm. fine. But is the t-test the right test? You have to really go back to the basics that you learned in undergrad that you forgot about many years ago, and it's all on the internet. You can find it quite easily, guidelines for the basics. But I think there are other courses that you can find, even if it's not hosted at the FMP. But this was one of the things that someone had mentioned as a good idea to host ourselves as well.
And going back to the initial question that you said, you reflected a bit about your career perspectives and what you want to do next. And it's okay not to have a final answer, of course. But do you see yourself pursuing a professorship?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, right now, of course, I'm just in my first year of my postdoc. So everything is still, I can still see that things could happen that are good. Mm-hmm. Like my experiments all work. I have this nice story. I make a nice high impact paper, and then I have this easy pathway to professorship. But that's not how it is. Of course, I can see it, but I can also see everything going horribly wrong, which is okay. And I'm fine with this because I know what else is out there. And I know there are a lot of really cool jobs that aren't in academia. And I would be happy with those as well, I'm pretty sure. Because at the end of the day, why would I want to be a professor? Why would I want to pursue a research career? Because the research career so far especially has ticked certain boxes for me. A lot of the problem solving, a lot of the critical thinking, these are things that I really like. The atmosphere, the working atmosphere, and we're all really nerdy. So having like-minded people as well. I'm confident that I can find all the things that I'm excited about for a research career in other aspects of careers.
And you just mentioned that you also think that things might go wrong and then you have to pursue a different career and not a professorship. What do you mean by wrong? And do you think that the failure would be an obstacle for you? A failure in your experiments, for example, if the experiment go wrong, would be an obstacle for you to become a professor?
Right. So yes, so one thing that I've seen a lot actually recently on Twitter, of course, is that you can do absolutely everything right. You can have a stellar publication record, you can have a cool research plan, and things might still not work out for you in the faculty search. So when you're trying to find a tenure track research position to have your own lab. And so if you have only failure in your research, of course, if you cannot publish a high enough impact paper or enough papers, it depends on, of course, where you're applying and what field you're in, then, you know, it's not going to necessarily pan out for a professorship. So, of course, this type of failure can lead to no professorship. But I think people need to be more realistic going in that this can happen and make peace with it. Because you can, like I said before, you can still have an amazing career outside of academia. And I think that a lot of people, especially people who've not had the time to think about careers in general, and they've never met a brick wall, really, mm-hmm. per se. And that can be, I think, a really big challenge because you have this identity as a researcher in academia, and you have that for a long time, if you think about it. Your undergrad years, like 3 to 6 years, depending on where you are, your master's 1 to 3 years, and then your PhD can be up to 8 years in mm-hmm. some countries. So you have so many years of your life as a researcher, and then suddenly you're no longer in academia. And I think that's a really big identity crisis for some people. Mm-hmm. But if you make peace with it earlier on, mm-hmm. then it's, I think, a smoother transition.
Yeah, and you're also more prepared for it.
Yes, 100%. You should
technically
be prepared
in terms
for everything.
Of skills and in terms of...
Exactly. Yeah.
Great. Thank you very much. It was really a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you very much for your time too.
I have really enjoyed talking to Gillian and hearing her thoughts and reflections about the work in academia in general and her personal path in science. I hope you've also found it interesting. And if you would like to hear other stories from this series, subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. Or you can simply visit the Forschungsverbund website. In the show notes, you can find the direct link to it. Take care. Bye-bye.